Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
Cipher is can be a person, place, a thing. But what was a cipher I was dealing with? I was dealing with the culture of our gods.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you try to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sataro. This is episode 211, A Talk with Divine. You may not have heard of Divine until now, but we wanted to share his story with you because it goes so many fascinating places and ends so inspirationally. He lived a life in the street that many people talk and rap about, but few have actually experienced, and almost none as deep as this. Divine, as he is fond of saying, has gone from crack to rap to tech. His wild story starts in Newport, Rhode Island, where his mother fell victim to crack cocaine while he was still a child. In order to make money, Divine started selling crack at 13 years old. Within just a few years, he was traveling up and down the East Coast, purchasing large quantities of high-quality cocaine in New York and trafficking it back to his home state. In 1993, as you'll hear, he was finally caught and sentenced to 7 years behind bars, time he would use to get further into the nation of gods and earths and to make connections that would help his career as a rapper when he got out, including meeting people from the legendary and notorious Fort Greene Projects in Brooklyn. Those same connections would lead him to have a relationship with one of the goats, the god himself, Rakim Allah, and the two would make music and tour together. But through all of that, Divine's connection to the street remained, and he would be in and out of jail, and occasionally even on the run. It was in 2012, through a Twitter-assisted meeting with a venture capitalist who happened to be a hip-hop fanatic, that a whole new chapter in Divine's life opened up, as a businessman. Even if you don't know his name now, you'll want to hear this incredible story. We talked to Divine at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you like the show, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecipher show. Every new patron helps get Josh one step closer to his dream vacation in Newport, and we've recently updated our rewards with some great new stuff. If you want to know any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecipher show.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cipher. And now, here's a man who's all about that VC life, Divine. Thanks for being on the show, man.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the craziest things that I was able to find out about you is actually not about you, but about your mother, that she was raised by nuns. Is that true?
Yeah, she was. She was raised as a ward of the state by nuns during that time in New Bedford, Massachusetts. But she was born in Tewksbury, Mass.
So did you grow up Catholic then?
Early on, I was actually going to Catholic school. My mother had met my father in New Bedford, Massachusetts at a social club. Eventually, he became pregnant. In a relationship, she moved to Newport, Rhode Island. And my early childhood, she had put me and my brother in Catholic school.
Wow. What was that? Like, were you sort of chafing against it early on?
Nah. Like, you know, I was like, I said in a previous interview where I looked at life through rose-colored lenses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how I looked at life. And I never really understood the dynamics and the harsh realities of life during that time. I just went with the flow. I really didn't really quite understand religion. My mother really didn't instill religion in me and my brother. I mean, we had little Bibles around, little kids' Bibles and things like that. But she never really like sat us down and explained Jesus Christ or anything else, you know?
Yeah.
So it was never really instilled, religion.
And you said Newport was a pretty racist town.
Extremely racist town. It's still even surprising me to this day when I look at my life where I've come.
Yeah.
That I was even born there. But you know, I know that, you know, everything happens in your life for a reason. There's a greater purpose behind it. But me being born in Newport, Rhode Island is even crazier when you look at the timeline of my life and where my life went and where I am today. But Newport growing up has always been racist, extremely racist. I've dealt with it all my life, so racism was never removed from me.
Right.
And understanding the dynamics of racism and being black, being young, and especially during the crack epidemic, you know,
When did you first start to figure out some of the dynamics of your town being racist?
Well, being young, you know, because my mother was on drugs before I got into the drug game, I was somewhat wayward, right? I had no parental guidance, a single parent home with my mother. My father was, I knew who my father was. He was actually very, very prominent in the town of Newport. But I never really interacted with him on a daily basis as far as fatherhood goes. So as a youth, just traveling through Newport, you know, with the BMX bikes going here and there, I would go into stores and I would feel the racism. I would feel the bias. I mean, by all means, even though I was in there probably up to something anyway, you know, nevertheless, it was still there, you know, you could feel it.
Yeah.
You know, just with police interaction. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, the court system interactions early on, me being wayward and doing things. I did a lot of stealing when I was real young. Just, you know, just getting into troubles, man, you know, into troubles because I had no parental guidance, no mentorships or role models. Mm-hmm.
But the cops and the stoners and stuff were more likely to suspect you of doing that kind of kid stuff, and it may have had heavier consequences then.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, and being black, you know, you look at Newport. I mean, if you go back to those days, the makeup of African Americans, blacks in Newport, Rhode Island versus the white population.
Currently Newport is about 83% white and 7% African American.
I mean, you have to look at it, first of all, Rhode Island is the smallest state in the nation, and Newport's the smallest city in Rhode Island.
Right.
You know what I mean? So you could do the math on that.
Right. And so when you're about 10, something happened. You've talked about how your mom had a breakdown. I think that was what you called it.
Yeah.
Was that sudden? Was that a gradual process? How did you realize something was off?
My mother never really involved me and my brother in her personal life like that, as far as with my father and how that goes. So he's never really inside that adult mindset of what she was going through with my father. You know, he was known to be a philanderer, you know, a womanizer, promiscuous, whatever the case may be. And I learned that later on in life. So I didn't know the problems that were maybe brewing that were already there and just came to a head.
Mm-hmm.
But what really I think really pushed my mother over the edge was, you know, she thought she had married him. She did an elaborate wedding, spent tens of thousands of dollars on it, you know, from the photographer, from the gowns, tuxes, you know, the reception, all that. And to come to find out that he was still married, hadn't gotten a divorce. So that I think that pushed her over the edge, because she loved my father, still loves him to this day. She had that emotional mental breakdown. And then she made choices that she normally wouldn't have made by getting involved with unscrupulous individuals and then allowing them to lead it down paths that she was never exposed to.
Right.
You know, my mom didn't drink or do drugs, even smoke or none of that. I picked that up from her, you know?
Yeah. How does the transition go? She starts doing drugs. You're around 10 or 11. And then it's not long after that that you get involved in dealing drugs and start going down to Philly, going down to New York. You're maybe like 12, yeah. 13. How does that transition happen?
So what happened was when it took place with my pops, I came home from Catholic school and came home. And we actually was living in an area that's middle class. It was middle class at the time. Now it's subsidized housing. Right now, but it was middle class at the time. Great neighborhood, grew up around great people. Come home, go in a house, and there's a whole bunch of people in my house. And she's having like a house sale, and everything in the house is going. She's selling everything in the house, everything. And unbeknownst to me and my brother just coming home, seeing this, coming home from Catholic school and just seeing this. So I was like, definitely, you know, perplexed.
So no warning, just one day. I was bewildered,
like then, no warning, no nothing.
Wow.
And then next thing I know, she's saying that we're going to be staying with our older sister for a little while she goes, sets up shop and send for us in another state. The state she ended up going to was Louisiana. So she went down there, I think 6 months later, or sent for me and my younger brother. And we flew down on Delta down there to live for about 6 months to about a year, I believe. And I was around 11. I had a spiritual experience prior to that happening. I was riding one day in my neighborhood, and I had this bike. Bike was called the Rampart at the time. And it was like one of my favorite bikes I got for my birthday. And I'm riding my bike and the sun is going down. The sun's about to set. And I'm riding my bike and this feeling comes over me. And the feeling, for me to describe it in words, was a voice. And I looked up into the sky. And I looked up and I heard the voice said, "Don't worry, everything's going to be all right." And I never understood that spiritual experience until later on we're getting to my incarceration and my spiritual development,
right,
while incarcerated.
Right. So, you know, you get involved in stuff. You're traveling down to Philly, to New York. I was interested in Philly, right? You start going down there, maybe your early teens. Music wise, what was going on? Were you exposed to like different Philly rap artists when you were there?
Yeah. So what's interesting is about Newport. Newport has, in Rhode Island, Newport's the only city that has a naval base. So a lot of individuals would be shipped in and out of that naval base. And a lot of them would befriend the locals. So there's a particular dude from out of Philly who was in the Navy, who befriended the locals, and was in the drug dealing. Mm-hmm. So me and him had linked up through a mutual acquaintance, and I learned that, you know, he was supplying and bringing drugs to Newport. So me and him had linked up, and we started hustling together. And it was through him and his people that I first got exposed to Philadelphia. Now Philly at the time was popping as far as the music scene goes. You had Cool C. You had Steady B, the Hillside Hustlers, Three Times Dope, you know, of course, Schoolie D.
This flame, anytime that you want it, I'm your giver, and you can bet money that I'll deliver. The satisfaction is guaranteed. You want a break from weaklings? You need.
Just cruising down the Ave with my homeboy Boo, laying back like Jack Mellor went to the groove. The greatest man alive was cold rock in my world. Then I rocked a little harder when I saw this fresh fly girl. But hold up, I can't go out like nothing. I had to conjure up a cool way to strut.
Looking at my Gucci, it's about that time.
You know, looking at my Gucci, like, so I was already in tune with Philly hip hop from Schoolie D. When I met my man, I got more entrenched into Philly culture and the Philly hip hop scene. And I was listening to more artists, and Cool C was one of my favorites at the time. So being exposed to that, going down to Philly, and that was my first exposure actually to Black Muslims.
A lot of people don't really
know that they have a strong Muslim community in the African American community. A majority of them that come out of Philly are Muslim. I mean, if you look at I think Meek Mill. Mm-hmm. If you look at Beanie Siegel, Freeway.
As I wake up in the morning, stretch my arms wide before I even yawn to wipe the cold out my eyes. I say alhamdulillah, giving praise to my God, allow me another day, blessing me to rise.
Stay close to my mama, keep toasters for drama, makes a lot with my son. My son growing and he learning a lot. That's what them toasters want to burn as a pop. Rain on your umbrella.
Those brothers are all Muslim, or were raised Muslim. So it was crazy going down there and getting introduced to Beef Bacon, you know, turkey bacon and all that. Like, you know what I mean? I never knew about none of that stuff. So that was exposed. But also when I went to Philly.
Oh, turkey bacon, because they couldn't eat pork.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, gotcha. Well, they didn't eat pork, right? So that was, it was common.
Gotcha.
But when I realized, that's when I really understood poverty. I wouldn't really understand poverty and the projects until I went to Philly. Mm-hmm. That was my first exposure. Not my first exposure, because I went to New York prior to that. But that was like my real exposure, seeing like really like this is the hood. This is really projects. Where I live, what I call the hood and what I'm experiencing, that's like townhouses. Mm-hmm. So that was an ill contrast right there.
Yeah.
From how I seen what poverty was and the projects to what I really seen in Philly. And the last note on that, I would like to say that I realized that was my first time realizing that white people were impoverished, were just as impoverished as Black people. Because I seen a whole neighborhood of white people. It was the hood. It was the projects. And they were poor in Philly.
You started spending a lot of time in New York during that period also, right?
Yeah.
That was the Bronx and not yet Brooklyn. Brooklyn would kind of come later.
Brooklyn came later on. So the Bronx, first of all, I always had a strong affinity for New York City through hip-hop.
Mm-hmm. As hip-hop, we can tell from the Yankee hat you're wearing right now.
No doubt. New York. I always got a rep, man. You know what I'm saying? I always make it known I rep Brooklyn. And there's a reason why, which we'll get into later. But if we think about New York hip hop at the time, early 80s, golden era. New York hip hop's on the map, killing it, right? Influencing every part of the nation with hip hop. So I was always listening to hip hop as a youth. I was heavily entrenched in it. I loved it. I was a diehard hip hop head, hip hop fan. and everything I listened to was, you know, was New York hip hop. So that was my first introduction to hip hop in New York City, mm-hmm. rather, and how I became so attached to it. So later on, some brothers from a family from out of New York, from the Bronx, would move to Newport to get away. They would start hustling in the streets in Newport, and I would befriend them, and they would take me as a young teenager. I was probably like 13, maybe 13, 14. They would take me to New York City with them to go visit their family. And I would go right to the birthplace of hip hop, the Bronx. I first touched down in New York City, myself, my 2 feet in the Bronx, man. And that's when I seen, yo, New York is ill. And that really even brought more of an affinity for New York City, that experience there.
Yeah. You continue hustling and stuff, and you know, you get a long sentence when you're 19, I think is when you get locked up for the 84 months for 7 years.
Yeah, exactly. After we came back from Louisiana with my mom's, that's when she got addicted to crack cocaine, you know, the 80s, crack epidemic and all that. So for me to really survive and to get food and clothing and things of that nature, I had to go to the streets and start hustling. So I started hustling crack. I was very, very intelligent the way that I moved in the streets at a young age. I was always mature for my age and mature beyond my years. So I started grinding and hustling, and eventually I would become very, very substantial in the drug trade in Newport, Rhode Island, and even throughout the entire Rhode Island. My name would ring from Newport all the way to the capital city of Providence. And we actually call, the guards actually call Providence New Medina or New Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was so many murders going down out there. And it was wild.
How quick did crack change things?
I mean, if you think about Newport, Rhode Island being known as America's first resort. Like, come on, like, think about that.
Right.
Like, in this day, I think Taylor Swift has a home there, right?
Located in America's first resort, Newport, Rhode Island.
America's first resort is the slogan for Newport's Visitors Bureau and even appears on the official city documents. Taylor Swift's almost $18 million seaside mansion, which she reportedly paid for in cash, is technically in nearby Watch Hill, Rhode Island.
Michael Jackson had been in there back in the day, and these different stars that came to Newport to relax and enjoy, you know, a little R&R. Anyway, so Newport's always been flooded with tourists in the summer times. But if you think about the crack epidemic in the 80s, could even touch the smallest city in the smallest state in the Union.
Yeah.
That should tell you the dynamic or the diabolical reach that crack cocaine had in the 80s, man, in the drug war.
How quickly do you remember that spreading?
So, okay, it first started like this. When crack first hit and became a trade, a lot of the brothers from Providence came down because they were really from the city. Newport was more, a little bit more slower than Providence with certain things. But I was always ahead of my time, and I was always mature for my age. So I was like one of the only Newport cats that was traveling, you know, to Providence as a youth, you know, and experiencing the city and, like, you know, traveling on my own and things of that nature. A lot of the brothers from Providence came down to Newport and kind of took over the drug scene, controlled the drug scene. That would eventually change when eventually all of them would get, you know, arrested. Indictments would come out. They had sold crack to undercover agents or whatever it was. And then the Newport scene would take over. And that's when I started flourishing. But that, like, happened like in almost like a blink of an eye. That was very, very fast. I had gotten to the game, and I was actually working for an African brother named Fish at a Providence. And I was still going to junior high school at the time.
Wow.
I'm going there with like knots of money, like $2,000-$3,000. I'm having the flyest kicks on, you know, the shell toe Adidas, Pumas. Like, I had the flyest the striped Lee pants, you know, the matching Lee jacket with the acrylic tag on the back. Like, I had all that, right? Because I was making that money. But as fast as I started working for him, just as fast as I started working on my own, one of my guys that I had grew up with in the drug trade, he kind of took me and my man under his wing, and he had access to powder cocaine. So that's when I started purchasing powder and then cooking up myself in the quote-unquote crack, because it's not really crack. It's just base cocaine. But the federal government looks at that as one and the same. If it's cooked up, it's a more pure form of cocaine because it's the base. All the impurities are cooked out of it, and they equate that with crack.
Divine is dead on here. Many laws that were written specifically to apply to crack cocaine offenders, like the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, don't actually use the words crack cocaine in their text. So they have been applied to anyone who possesses substances or mixtures that contain cocaine base.
Crack is when you take powdered cocaine and mix it with like ammonia or bleach, something that adds to makes the high actually go away quicker. It makes you come back quicker. Whereas raw base cocaine, you're gonna be high for days.
All of this happens, and you know, eventually, like I said, you get this 7-year sentence.
Yeah,
and you kind of saw firsthand how the legal system changed in response to crack because of that case. Can you talk about that?
Right. Yeah. So eventually, like I said, I became a substantial drug dealer, one of the biggest in Newport, going back and forth to New York City, purchasing kilos of cocaine. I get about a kilo a week. 171st in Amsterdam, Spanish Harlem. I go up there, grab my drugs, shoot down to 125th.
Only about 60 blocks from where we are right now.
Yeah, 60 blocks from where we are right now.
Yeah.
Exactly. I go to Spanish Harlem, cop my drugs, shoot down to 125th, and be purchasing African-American and Black empowerment books. Like, you know, which is an ill contrast, right? Grabbing kilos of coke and I'm going down grabbing kilos of books. You know what I mean? So it was crazy at those times. But I was young. I was determined to win. And, you know, that's just what it was. But I eventually got arrested. I was sentenced to 84 months in federal prison, 7 years. But they always calculate it on the monthly, as a monthly range. And
how did you feel when you first heard that number? Did you know that number was coming?
Well, that's even crazy. So that's another dynamic of my story and the experience, because I'm thinking I was charged in the state first, right? So I got one of the illest mob attorneys in the state at the time. They called him Jack Cicilline. He actually had defended some of the Patriarca and the Gambino crime family members.
Boy, you better run to your mama now.
For more about the Patriarca crime family and attorney Jack Cicilline, you can check out the incredible podcast Crime Town.
So what happened was, I'm in the state. They offered me 30 years, right? 10 to serve.
They offered it to you.
They offered me 30 years.
That was a great...
Yeah, exactly. The first time I went to court. I mean, that's how big I was at the time. I mean, I was a kid. I was a teenager, but I was that dude. Like, I was the guy to get, you know what I'm saying? Straight up and down. And everybody will attest to that from where I'm from, whether they hate on me or they don't. They know what it is. The history's laid down. The legacy is what it is. Anyway, they offered me 30 years, 10 to serve. So I'm like, yeah, that's nothing. I'm thinking, you know, I got the illest mob attorney in Rhode Island. You know what I'm saying? I'm good. You know, ain't nothing. We gonna rock. And I also understood the legal system from being arrested as a juvenile. Prior to that, I understood how the system worked, and I knew they had to offer me 3 deals. That's kind of how the procedure went in state court. They offer you 3 deals. But the first deal they offer me, if they offer me 30 years, the first deal, 10 to serve, then I know I can get them down to, you know, maybe 5-2 to serve or something like that. So I was good. And I knew it was my first time. Mm-hmm. So I knew I wouldn't serve the entire sentence. I make my first shot parole, had never been arrested as an adult. So I was cool with that.
Right.
But then I get this visit, and it was like meeting with the devil himself. Federal government came in and said they were taking my case over because they had this thing called the crack law, a draconian crack law during the Reaganomics, and the war on drugs was instituted at a federal level. And they started applying drug laws that were actually in place for pharmaceutical companies. These harsh sentences were for pharmaceutical companies because they were given the public trust. So the sentences was harsh if you did certain things with drugs at that level in business. They started applying those to low-level drug dealers after I had been arrested. First it was high-level, and then it turned, and you look in the 80s, the whole sweep throughout New York City from all the big cats that was doing big things out here in New York with kilos of cocaine, hundreds of kilos of cocaine at the time. They started sweeping those, and then they started applying that to the lower-level drug dealers. I fell in at a high level for the place that I was at and the age that I was. So they hit me with the draconian crack law, and that was like a 1,000-time ratio per gram from powdered cocaine, crack cocaine.
These are disparities that only now are starting to be addressed.
It was addressed the whole time I was incarcerated, never seen a change, never affected my sentence, and now they just have kind of brought it down. Right. I think it's maybe 10 to 1 now.
Face it, Jerome get more time than Brandon. And at
the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010 reduced the 100-to-1 disparity between crack and powder cocaine sentences to 18-to-1. It also eliminated the 5-year mandatory minimum sentence for crack possession.
1,000 grams of cocaine was equal to 1 gram of crack.
Right.
So you can get caught with 1,000 grams. You know what I mean? You get caught with one gram of crack. It's a wrap for you. It's if you had 1,000 grams of powder.
Right.
So I fell into that. So I had a mandatory minimum sentence. And the mandatory minimums was another aspect to that law. Or to that federal sentencing guidelines that came out. So I fell underneath the mandatory minimum, 5 years mandatory minimum. Then my criminal history, things I was already tried for, things I was already convicted for, sentences that I already paid my my debt to society for, crimes.
Mm-hmm.
I was re-criminalized for those. And points were raised to push me over to a minimum 7 years, brought me to 7 years. But prior to that, they tried to give me 11 years. That's the first thing my lawyer told me. That's because I had guns attached to my case. It's crazy because the guns were my guns.
Mm-hmm.
And they end up just charging me and my co-defendant equally. Because he was like almost 20 years my senior. You know, so I was 19. He was like 39.
Yeah.
You know? But they end up charging us both. They end up just dropping the guns. So it brought our sentence down from 11 years to bringing us to the 5 years mandatory minimum. And then the criminal history points brought me up to 7 years.
Right. So while you're in for that, is that when you first came across the Gods and Earths?
No, I initially started getting knowledge of self and studying when I was in a juvenile facility a year prior
mm-hmm.
to being locked up in the adult facility. And that's an interesting story. What had happened was some guards or some brothers out of Brooklyn had came down to Rhode Island to take over the drug trade. So they end up getting caught in a hotel with a cache, a stockpile of weapons, automatic weapons, you know, and drugs. And they became the youngest individuals in Rhode Island to ever be sentenced under the RICO statute. But they were 5%ers. They were all from out of Brooklyn. And they started teaching and spreading knowledge throughout the adult facility.
Mm-hmm.
I was adjacent to that in the juvenile facility at the time. And one of my brothers I grew up with in the drug trade, he was actually incarcerated with them. So he started getting knowledge himself through them. He was the first one at Newport to get knowledge. And I was like the third individual. But what had happened was I started seeking knowledge while incarcerated, started reading Malcolm X. I read Malcolm X's autobiography by Alex Haley. And that kind of put me in that zone to start doing more research on who W.D. Fard was.
Right.
Who Master Fard was, who Elijah Muhammad was.
W.D. Farad, a.k.a. Wallace Farad Muhammad, founded the Nation of Islam in 1930 in Detroit. Muhammad met Elijah Poole the following year and trained Poole for 3.5 years to become his successor. Poole, who became the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, took over the organization in 1934 after Farad disappeared. Farad's disappearance is obviously mysterious, and the FBI kept an open file on him until at least 1960. He is even alleged by some to have remained involved with the Nation of Islam under the name Muhammad Abdullah, who was appointed Imam of Muhammad's Mosque No. 77 in Oakland, California in 1976 and passed away in 1992. Other rumors even suggested Elijah Muhammad had Farad killed. Elijah Muhammad went on to lead the Nation of Islam until his death in 1975 and was also an early teacher and mentor to Malcolm X. After Elijah Muhammad's death in 1975, the Nation of Islam briefly fell apart until it was restarted in 1978 by Louis Farrakhan.
And just the way Malcolm just spoke and the way he came across, even in written word, was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So I started getting privileges to go to the local library, leaving outside the gates in the juvenile facility, going to the library. And my first book after that was Black Muslims in America by C. Eric Lincoln. I started reading that, and that brought me deeper down the quote-unquote rabbit hole, if you would.
Yeah.
And so that's how I started doing it. And then there was a big article in... you might not recall this article, but there was a big write-up in Rolling Stones
mm-hmm.
on the influence of the 5% Nation of Islam and 5%ers in hip-hop. And they featured Poor Righteous Teachers, King's Son, Eric B. and Rakim, so forth and so on. And that's where I kind of learned more about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I started getting deeper into it. And then I received a letter when I got to the adult facility a year later from my man. And he told me I was running this brother from out of Brooklyn, who was being transferred back to the Rhode Island prison, another prison, because they had basically broke all them brothers up because they were causing upheaval in the prisons, and actually they sparked a big riot.
Wow. And so you start meeting 5%ers, you get knowledge of self. Were these a lot of the people who were from Fort Greene Projects?
Yeah, so all the brothers that came up and first started spreading knowledge of self about the adult facility in Rhode Island, we're from Fort Greene Projects mm-hmm. or Fort Greene or Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
Majority of them was from Fort Greene Projects, specifically the infamous Fort Greene projects that you hear about.
Right, and this is where the paid in full posse
exactly,
comes from.
Exactly.
Yo, Rockin, what's up? Yo, I'm doing the knowledge, E, man. I'm trying to get paid in full. Well, check this out.
The paid in full posse was a group of some of the best-known rappers, gangsters, and hustlers of the mid-1980s. They were largely based out of Brooklyn's Fort Greene Projects. Many of the crew's members were photographed on the back cover of Eric B. and Rakim's album Paid in Full, thus the crew's name. You can hear Rakim and Supreme Magnetic, another member of the crew, break down that photo on episode 65. Some of the members included Supreme and his brother Rap, Killer Ben O'Garo, and Kelvin Martin, a.k.a. the original 50 Cent. You can hear more on episode 190 with Paradise Gray.
All that history you hear, you know, Rap, Supreme, Magnetic, which you know some of that history through Rakim, and, you know, a lot of rappers that used to go through there, either getting robbed, the original 50 Cent was from Fort Greene Projects, all that. Anyway, so what happened was I actually met one of the brothers. That's my man that ripped me that letter and told me you run into him. I actually did run into him. So I'm sitting in the rec room, just chilling, watching TV or whatever I was doing. And he's talking loud. He's in the shower and he's talking loud to somebody. He's like, yeah, you know this brother named Sincere, and that was a brother that I grew up with. His name was another name at the time, but he became Sincere.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked over at the brother, and then he looked at me. He's like, yo, you from Newport? I'm like, yeah, I was born out there. What's good? And so he explained who he was. He told me his name was Understanding. I was like, oh, you the brother that Sincere had wrote me about.
Mm-hmm.
And said I would meet you. So I said, yeah, peace, whatever. I said peace to him because I kind of already understood the basics of how the culture of the Nation of Gods and Earth, so the 5% Nation went. I said peace to him, whatever. That same day, that evening, we had Rec Yard. We went out to the Rec Yard and I walked up to him. I'm like, yo, Sincere told me to ask you if you'll build with me. So that was exactly what Sincere told me,
right,
to ask him if he'll build with you. So I didn't quite understand that term fully, but I was like, yo, will you build with me? And he looked at me awkwardly. He's like, come on. And we started walking the Rec Yard. And then he started asking me questions that were kind of like, you know, I had answers to them. They really didn't blow my mind, but it wasn't your ordinary questions. So first question he asked me is, who was the original man?
He's asking you the 1 through 10.
Yeah.
Right.
No, yeah, it's through the Roman 1 through 10.
This Asiatic black man is a dog spelled backwards. The maker, the owner, the cream of the planet Earth, father civilization, god of the universe.
Divine is talking about a series of questions and answers written by W.D. Farad, which are supposed to be memorized. The first 10 questions or degrees are known as the student enrollment. The very first question is, who is the original man? The answer is, the original man is the Asiatic black man, the maker, the owner, the cream of the planet Earth, father of civilization, god of the universe.
So he asked me, who is the original man? And I looked at him, I said, black man. He's like, you know what original means? I'm like, yeah, original means the number one, first copy, you know what I mean? So I really got exactly what I said, but he was really surprised that I kind of knew
the basics of these things,
right? And I didn't study any lessons. I never set my eyes on any lessons at this time.
Oh.
Yeah, I'd never read any lessons. I just knew this from my studies from reading in the juvenile facility, you know, the Malcolm X autobiography, as well as Black Muslims in America.
Right.
And, you know, in that Rolling Stone article.
Interesting.
That was really like my education at that point.
Wow.
And then the books I was buying when I was coming back and forth
to
New York after copping cocaine on 171st, you know, when I got done on 125th, I was buying, you know, crazy books because at that time I kind of like took on a little attribute, a different name.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it wasn't ingrained, right? I hadn't experienced it enough.
Yeah. Tell me about the name. So you ended up getting Divine Lord Magnetic Allah.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you pick a name, pick an attribute?
Well, I think everyone has a different way they pick their attributes. I think it's some look at what they already have within them, qualities, whatever part of, you know, whatever stands out, but that's positive about their character, whatever they aspire to become. But for the most part, it's mostly done through a system of breaking down your birth name,
right? When you use some of the letters of your birth name.
Using Supreme Mathematics, Supreme Alphabet.
One is knowledge. Two is wisdom. Three is understanding. The devil's underhanded. Four is culture, freedom. Five is power, refinement. Six is equality. Newborns follow me. Seven is God. Eight is build or destroy. Nine is born. You forget to rewind the song. Zero is cipher. Now there you have it. Because I sincerely love Allah's mathematics.
Supreme Mathematics and Supreme Alphabet are systems within the Nation of Gods and Earths, whereby numbers and letters, respectively, are associated with words. For example, the number zero is associated with the word cipher, as is the letter O.
So my birth name was Victor Damon Lombard, but I was always called Damon. So that's kind of what I built it off of. So if we break my name down using Supreme Alphabet, it's I would say Divine Allah, Master Cipher Now.
Right.
So what I started realizing was going through that experience of learning Supreme Mathematics, Supreme Alphabets, which I would which I actually got from the Rolling Stone article, which I came across in the juvenile facility, but then understanding would then give me the actual breakdown of all the math and all the alphabet. So I would look at that and I would be like, okay, I'm going through a transformation right now, spiritual transformation. I come into this knowledge. So now that I understand what Damon means using supreme alphabets and supreme mathematics, even breaking it down even further, Divine Allah Master Cipher now is telling me something. It's speaking to me. It's saying Divine Allah Master Control Cipher now. Cipher is can be a person, place, a thing. But what was the cipher I was dealing with? I was dealing with the culture of our God. So that was the cipher, Master Cipher now, or even Master Myself now, right now, not tomorrow, not weeks from now. Now is your time. You're coming into a spiritual transformation. This is where it starts. So that's how I got Divine Allah, and then understanding put forth the Lord Magnetic, because I was always somebody who was a leader. And he had already known about me. I meant to mention this to you. He had already knew about me because my name was that powerful and that strong in the drug game. He had already known who I was based off the history of everybody telling him about me. Mm-hmm. And he was incarcerated. So when he built with me himself, he's like, okay, you need a whole Lord Magnetic as well. So that's why I got the Lord, meaning self-righteous ruler, because I was always a leader, and then the Magnetic, because I always had charisma and that power of attraction,
right,
to draw people to me. And then we go back to Magnetic, we'll talk about later.
Right.
Time to Four Green Brooklyn.
Of course.
Four Green Projects.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You do this time, you get out, and music comes to the forefront again with Supreme Records.
Yeah, exactly.
Supreme Records was something you formed and actually sort of got going for a little while. You had some showcases, you put some stuff out. Tell me about that.
Yeah, process. So when I got incarcerated and when I got the federal sentence, that's when federal prison wasn't as violent as it is today. Well, at least not the lower levels, mediums. The mediums was always violent, but like the low securities and all that. My goal in my mind, I set out to was, I need to get through this sentence the best way I can, the fastest way I can, and get as much knowledge as I can. I can't go back home being who I was. Mm-hmm. And I have to at least be at the same level everybody else is at when that's out there or above and beyond. So my focus was to stay out of trouble, stay focused, and build my mind. And that spirituality was what did it for me. So I started building my mind up. And I also made the decision that I was going to be a hip-hop rap recording artist. And I was going to use my newfound knowledge to uplift people through music, get positive messages through music. So that's when I determined that I'm going to be this hip-hop rap recording artist. But I also wanted to control my destiny in that realm. So I also started studying books, everything I could on the music industry from A to Z. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started formulating Supreme Records while in prison. And when I came home, that's when I put it together. And I did my first showcase here in New York City at renowned Club Speed. Did my thing, put it down. First time performing in New York City. My first time performing in New York City, and really my first time performing as a professional hip hop rap recording artist.
Right.
Right. That was like my debut. And to come to New York and set it off there and then get the love that I got was just like the seal that I knew this was what I was meant to do.
What kind of ended up derailing Supreme Records?
I couldn't get funded. Like I couldn't get funded. I couldn't get the money I needed from banks, traditional sources of funding when you build a company. I didn't really understand, you know, the dynamics of credit, character, collateral. You know what I mean? Those things that you need when you go to get a loan from the bank. So I tried all those positive routes. I got discouraged and I went back to the streets. So it wasn't even so much that we got derailed, they just needed to be funded properly. Mm-hmm. And I still say to this day that the reason I'm not an average household name in hip hop, in the history of hip hop, is because I never got the right backing or the right financing and made the right connections to be put on that stage. I always had the skills, straight up and down. From prison, skills tested. I've been compared to the best of them. From Nas, Wu-Tang, Rakim, Guru. Always been compared to the best of them in prison. And put in that pedestal and treated that way throughout prison. And even in the streets when I was doing my thing. I just never had the right team, never had the money, never had the backing or the opportunities. Mm-hmm. To really do it. I was doing it on my own. So that's kind of what kept Supreme Records from flourishing and really kept my career as an artist under the radar and underground for the most part.
You were supposed to be a part of some Rock Chem related project called The Last Platoon, right? What was that and why didn't that pop off?
Okay, so So I had met Rock Chem's people on 125th, this tattoo spot they had. I walked in their tattoo spot and I saw pictures of Rock Chem there and other hip hop artists. So I was like, oh, what's this all about? I talked to the owner, and the owner happened to be Rock Chem's people. He's like, oh, I'm Rock Chem's peeps, whatever, whatever. I was like, oh, that's crazy. I get compared to Rock Chem a lot with my lyricals. You know, I'm definitely inspired by Ra. You know, and we have a lot of similarities that I'll speak on later, just personally and professionally. So anyway, I shared my music with him, and he was like, wow, you do sound like Ra. You actually look like Ra as well. And it, actually, Rakim's cousin was in the building. She comes out and she's like, yeah, he does look like Ra. And this is when I was like, you know, a lot more skinnier and, you know, my cheekbones in a little bit more, you know what I mean? Like, you know, like Rakim or whatever. But I learned why that was too, why we have a lot of physical features that are similar later on when I connected with Ra. So he wanted to connect me with Ra at the time, and we were supposed to meet. And he had told me about this group that Rakim had called The Last Platoon that he was going to be bringing out. And he was like, yo, I'm going to get you to be a part of this. I'm going to present you to Ra as one of the artists I'm going to bring to the table for The Last Platoon. So me and him built a strong brotherhood, and I was staying in contact with him constantly. A few times he tried to connect me with Ra. I just make it to New York. Ra had just left the tattoo spot, and, you know, I just missed Rakim by, like, minutes. So I always knew, like, prior to that and throughout prison that I was destined to meet Rakim. I knew that there was, like, I just knew it would happen. I don't know why, but I always felt it.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we missed each other, and during that time, I would come to meet Rakim 7 years later. So that's kind of how all that developed with Rakim in the world.
Yeah, and just a number that obviously has significance.
Absolutely. Right. Seven is definitely my number. I know that's Ra's number as well. That's definitely my number. I'm deep into numerology. I'm deep into astrology, amongst other things, and other spiritual practices and systems.
So The Last Platoon just ends up not happening.
Yeah, it's Rakim, right? So, you know.
Right, so it's just kind of never...
It just fizzed out.
Yeah,
it fizzed out. It never happened.
And then things musically didn't pop off, like you said, because of the funding and because you were also, again, in and out of jail.
Yeah. I was in the drug game heavy. And be honest with you, I always did hip-hop because I loved it. I never really looked at hip-hop as a way... Even though I said I wanted to make it a career and be a professional hip-hop rap recording artist, I never really looked at it as a way to make money because I made money selling drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved hip-hop. I loved the art of writing. I love the art of spitting. I love the whole essence of what hip hop represented, especially from an MC perspective. Things never popped off because I was just getting money in the drug game. I wasn't 100% focused on being an artist.
Yeah.
And I was also somebody who was actually running everything myself. So I was my own manager. I was my own, you know, I built the label. I came up with the packaging. I did the photo shoots. I set all that up. So it was, everything was just me.
Mm-hmm.
I never had a team.
Yeah.
Which I spoke to earlier about why I know that's why I never really popped off.
Right. So speaking of your connections with street folks, with Brooklyn, with the Paid in Full posse, Bill Blass was someone
you got
to know who, you know, knew G-Rap and knew other members of the Paid in Full posse.
Who's that with the chick? Bill Blass, my sidekick. What's up, Black? Give us Santa smack.
Bill Blass, a native of the Brooklyn neighborhood of East New York, is a hard man to find out a lot of information about. Some might say that's because he shares a name with a famous fashion designer, while others might suggest that's because he chose to remain relatively mysterious as he was a, quote, man of the streets, as many called him, including as Divine will hear. Take that for what you will. Blass was known for mentoring aspiring hip-hop artists, particularly working closely with Kool G Rap, who said, quote, Bill Blass was my man. He was a real street dude out of Brooklyn. He ended up being my road manager for a while. He was in the video for Ill Street Blues and Road to the Riches, and on the back cover for Wanted Dead or Alive. I connected him with Eric B. Blass went on to be the longtime hype man and associate of Rakim. When Ra went solo in 1997, Bill stepped into a management role, and on Ra's 97 album, The 18th Letter, The Book of Life Part 1, Blass even produced the track The Mystery, Who is God? Blass has since passed away, but even the date and the cause of that is unclear, although some claim he was shot.
How did you hook up with him, and what was he like?
Yeah, Bill Blass, man, rest in power. That was my man, street legend, as well as legendary throughout hip-hop. Those that know of him, know of him. Those that don't, just don't. But Bill Blass was from East New York, Brooklyn. Legendary street dude, again. Legendary in the hip-hop game as well. Behind the scenes. Used to manage Kool G Rap, what I understand. Was involved with Rakim heavily for a while as well. Anyway, how I met Blass was when I went back to prison, when I was supposed to meet Rakim during that time, I violated, went back to prison. I ended up in New Jersey, Fairton. So I was while I was there, I was building with brothers on the compound who were also MCs out of New York. And you got to realize, my whole time through our federal prison, when I first went in, I only dealt with New York cats because that's all there was.
Mm-hmm.
And I vibed mostly with Brooklyn brothers, and also 5% brothers, which are mostly from New York City.
Of course, yeah.
So that's how I kind of built my foundation as far as dealing with, you know, my affinity for New York and connecting to New York with those brothers. Anyway, I met a lot of great brothers that I stayed in contact with throughout the time. So anyway, I had met this. So anyway, it was going around the compound that I was supposed to be in this group, Rakim, and I knew Rakim and all these other things that were going on. I had met Rakim, or, you know, whatever it was. So there actually was a brother there, my man out of Brooklyn named Bees, who was actually Blast's man. And he was actually around Ra and was supposed to be involved with the Last Platoon. So he knew exactly what it was. So brothers came to me and was like, yo, this is brother on the compound named Bees. He want to see you. He want to talk to you. You know, he heard about the Last Platoon connection and the Rakim connection. And he was down with that as well. He want to see you. So he want to meet you tonight in the band room. So I was like, all right, cool. Ain't nothing. Let's link. So I ended up going to the band room at the set time. And Bees is there. He's like, peace. I'm like, yo, peace. What's good? He's like, yo, what's good? You supposed to be down at the Last Platoon and riding all that? I'm like, yeah, man. And I started breaking down how it all transpired. And he was like, oh, all right, no doubt. And me and him clicked from the door. You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
Me and him clicked from the door. I told my history, you know, how I got Nas himself to Brooklyn, my brothers at a Medina, you know, trace it back to the father.
By the father, Divine means Clarence 13X, otherwise known as Allah, the founder of the Nation of Gods and Earths. You can hear about the father directly from a man who knew him, Allah B, on episode 151.
So he's from East New York. So that's how he knew Blast. I mean, Blast came up in East New York. So he was like, yeah, Blast is my man. So he started telling me, you know, the history of him and Blast and Rakim and all that. And, you know, and that's how we became tight, man. We built a brotherhood.
How did you eventually actually hook up with Rakim and go on tour with him?
Yeah, so, okay, so I was released and B's connected me with Blast in the streets. So I came out to Brooklyn, and you got to figure I was going back and forth to Brooklyn because that's where all my God fam, Thug fam was from.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always traveling throughout New York City and especially Brooklyn. And that's kind of how my connection to Brooklyn is solidified in a spiritual sense. So I came home, connected with Blast. But me and Blast, at the time, he was actually involved with Rakim. He was Rakim's point man when I toured with him.
What year is this, more or less?
Maybe 2001 that I connected with Blast.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so when me and Blast got together, it was strictly street. It was street level. You know what I'm saying? Street level things going on. And he was that dude in the streets. About Brooklyn, he had all the links and connects, and I didn't work quite, you know, I just got out, so I didn't build my connects throughout New York at the time. I was working with him. I started working with him in the streets, doing things, and we was building, just connecting on street level shit. So after that manifest, I actually built with him the fact that I connect with Rakim's peeps that was still involved with Ra some time back. I was like, yo, tell him I said peace, I'm home, I love to reconnect or whatever. But it didn't happen to probably like another 4 years later.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? It would happen like another 4 years later. I would meet Ra in 2006. I would go on tour with Rakim. And that happened because I connected with this multimillionaire jeweler who I went to and was copping my jewels from. And he wanted to manage me. So he started learning about the hip hop game through me. And then he linked up with some other people who actually was bringing Rakim to a show locally, to a local show in Rhode Island. And then he connected it so I could connect there at the show. And when I got to the show, Rakim's peeps that I met 7 years prior was there. And then who comes around the corner? Blast.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So I'm like, yo, I see Ra's peeps. I'm like, yo. I'm like, then I see Blast. I'm like, yo, it's good. And, you know, we all connect. And then there was an after party that night. And that's when I actually met Rakim. You know what I'm saying? I say the stars collided. And the first thing I said to Rakim, we was at an after party at Club Babylon, Providence, Rhode Island. And it was put on by my jeweler. Put it on. You know, I'm rocking. My jeweler had made me the seven with the eye. It's a hoodie in it. You know what I'm saying? The seven I had, it was like, it weighed like a kilogram, 1,000 gram chain.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Gold, crazy, crazy huge seven on it with the eye in the middle, with the tahuti eye in the middle.
So break down the tahuti eye for me, by the way. That's
So the tahuti eye is one of the eyes of Horus.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Egyptian god.
Gotcha.
Out of Egypt, which is a child between Isis and Osiris, and that's just one of the eyes. That represents one of the eyes. It represents the moon side. The eye of Ra which is the other side, which is the right side of the eye, represents the sun. So you have the positive and negative balances.
Gotcha.
So I had the hot eye Tahuti on there, which also represents divine wisdom. So it made sense that that was became my logo and everything else. Anyway, what would happen was, so I had the big chain on, you know, I'm doing my thing. So Ra comes out, and we you know, it's a celebrate Rakim, and it's after party for him. So I give him pound, I pull him into me, and I whisper in his ear, yo, I knew that we was destined to meet. I didn't know through who, I didn't know when, but I knew it would happen, man. And then I said that to him, whispered that in his ear. He just looks at me, and he says, all right, no doubt, G. And then we connected from there. And all night long, we was just chilling, taking pictures, you know what I'm saying, vibing. Blast was there, so me and Blast were like reminiscing, talking, and it was a great time. And at the time, Rakim was coming out with a new album, The Seventh Seal. So I actually ended up playing a role behind the scenes and almost being part of that getting financed. Things didn't pan out, but eventually, what happened was we just built more of a business relationship than a music one.
Mm-hmm.
But I did spend in a personal relationship as well. Spent time at Rakim's crib in his studio. He produced a song for me. Like, there's just different elements of meeting Ron, learning him on a personal level, as opposed from afar.
Mm-hmm.
But the business just fell out, and I would end up going on tour with him because of that. Prior to the business falling out, I would go on tour because of that connection, and everything just was, you know, was love at the time, man.
Yeah. So I wanted to jump ahead to you actually getting out of the drug game for good, which is like 2012-ish, somewhere around there.
It was
right around 2012. Once you decided, hey, I'm done with this, was that a difficult thing to do?
Yeah. It definitely difficult. I mean, you gotta look at it. I started hustling drugs at 13 years old, man. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Hustled drugs all my life. That's all I ever knew. And that's all I've ever done to bring revenue in, saying to maintain financially. So that's all I've ever known. So to let that go, it's almost like Linus with his blanket. You know, he ain't trying to let that blanket go.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That was my safety net, man, because it's something I knew I could do. Not only that I knew I could do, something I did very well, but not well enough that I never got incarcerated for it.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Yeah. But it's what I knew, man. And you know, I love the street life. I was in love with that because it was my savior. It's what I used to survive and better myself and better my predicament. Really, to be honest with you, it was a spiritual experience again. That it was an emotional experience as well, from the spiritual and the mental and emotional, coming from that high level, and you know, passing those different aspects of who we are, is when I met Ben Horowitz and he expressed a high level of belief in me. When I realized, like, I don't need a drug game. You know what I mean? I don't need a drug game. So I just got to leverage my intelligence, my supreme intelligence, and intellectual property. Everything that I've always engaged all my life to flourish in the drug game and to make moves in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
I just have to redirect that in another way and build, you know, being entrepreneurial, building a startup or something like that. But I knew I was beyond just an MC.
Right.
That's how I met Ben, through hip hop, and that's what kind of connected us.
Ben Horowitz, venture capitalist.
What do you believe that nobody else does? Like, do you have the courage to even say that?
Ben here is Ben Horowitz, billionaire investor and co-founder of the venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz, also known as A16Z. He's also a big hip-hop fan and starts off many of his essays with quotes from rap songs. Ben had formerly founded LoudCloud, which became Opsware and was then acquired by Hewlett-Packard in 2007 for $1.6 billion. Earlier, he had been a VP and GM at AOL, and he first worked with Mark Andreessen when he joined the company Andreessen founded, Netscape, back in 1995. Ben is on the board of several of the Andreessen Horowitz portfolio companies, including Foursquare, Genius, Lyft, Medium, and TransferWise. He's also on the board of Columbia University.
But I knew I was more than that. I knew I had much more to offer, not only being in Ben's circle, but just offer myself and who I was and offer the world. I knew it was beyond just music.
And so, you know, you connected with Ben, I know, via Twitter initially.
Yeah.
What did he say in that initial conversation that made you want to keep talking to him, other than the fact that he's Ben Horowitz and he's rich? What was it about that initial conversation?
Well, at the time, he wasn't even verified at the time on Twitter. It was a long shot, right? But it was something I thought about 2 years prior while I was incarcerated about doing. I read about him in prison. So when I read his blog entitled Legend of the Blind MC, it really compelled me to do it.
Well, We'll have a link to Ben's essay, The Legend of the Blind MC, in the show notes for this episode.
This was 2 years after I was out.
Right.
I seen him on TV.
And that's about a friend he grew up with who was in a, he was in a rap group with.
Yeah, exactly. Who had accidentally been shot and blinded.
Yeah.
And then and Ben used hip hop to keep his hopes alive, live, and they created a rap group and so forth and so on. So I was just moved that I learned that Ben's love for hip hop music was genuine. It was real, authentic, and there was a deep reason for it. You know what I mean? It touched the human soul, right? And human spirit. So that's what compelled me to reach out to him on Twitter. The first thing I said to him was, I've read about you while incarcerated. I would have never known. I was compelled and inspired by that, by your blog post, The Legend of the Blind MC. And then he responded back, how could you have known? How could you have known? And then I joked back and said, well, if that was the case, if I had known, next thing I would ask you for was a job. If I had known about A16Z and what he did in venture capital and who he was.
Mm-hmm.
So then I said, yeah, I just came. I think I showed him a picture of me and Rakim. Me and Rakim had just performed together. Not performed together. I performed at the same show that he was headlining
mm-hmm.
in the same stage, which was crazy. So anyway, that was in March. That was actually in February. And in March, I connected with Ben on Twitter and I showed him a picture and I said, yeah. Told him, you know, I just got through performing and all that. He's like, oh, that's crazy. The 18th letter and the 4th letter, right? So we joking about that. And at that point, I'm like, yo, this is really him. I'm like, yo, you follow me so I can direct message you in private. And that's kind of what
set it off.
And I told him my story everything. And I asked him, mentor me versus investing in my music.
Right.
And that's kind of what set that whole trajectory off.
Yeah. And I was curious about something, which is, you know, you, via him, via connections through him, you now know more about the startup world, right? You've been out to California a bunch, yeah. And you've kind of seen how startups work and, you know, have learned about them and worked in some of them at this point. What, if any, connections do you see between how drug markets operated when you were in them and how startups work?
Oh, man. Yeah, definitely. So since Ben, I've learned about the technology industry. I always looked at technology subjectively. I was always in music, producing music, using technology, the latest mm-hmm. technology to do that. I never looked at technology outside of myself. So when I met Ben, I started looking at technology objectively and as an industry, as well as a career path. And then I started learning about all these startups. But I had actually started reading while incarcerated, you know, about all these technology startups that were building these million-dollar companies. And but I still didn't look at technology objectively, even though I read about these stories because it was so removed from me.
Mm-hmm.
When I got to Silicon Valley around Ben and seeing it firsthand and you know, his success, knowing that he came from a background where wasn't born with millions of dollars or $1 billion, he built that. I was that intrigued me. I was inspired by that. So just being around him in his world was just so inspired by it, moved by it. So I started with like, yo, and I knew I had much more in me than just emceeing,
mm-hmm.
rapping. So that's when I kind of set out to build a startup. So in learning the startup game, when I built my company, I actually got into a program, type of accelerator or incubator that kind of shows you the ABCs of building a company and a startup.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned all these things. And that's when I started seeing the parallels of the drug game, the same things you have to do. You have to come up with a value proposition. What's your value proposition? What's your marketing strategy? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What's your cost to acquire a customer?
Mm-hmm.
How much you spend on materials? How do you source materials for your product?
And these are the things you're already thinking about, maybe not using that language.
Not at all. I wasn't using that language, but I was actually going through the process.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't understand what I was doing, what it was. You right. know, so I didn't know it was formatted. That way there was a formula or a format to it. That's why I always say, I came into formal entrepreneurship. I was always an entrepreneur. You know what I'm saying? And you know, in the grind in the street hustle that I exemplified in the streets, it applies to building a startup.
Right.
You know, even if hustle even harder, I would say in a sense, you know. And
right.
You know, they said grind that hustle. So there's a lot of parallels to definitely, you know, hustling in the streets in the drug game. And building a startup and entrepreneurship.
And, you know, one of the things that I'm sure you've had opportunity to see and think about in Silicon Valley is diversity in the tech world, right? Or
yeah.
or lack thereof, both yeah. at the level of employees and at the level of founders.
I did a little bit.
We should point out that this interview was recorded prior to the now infamous Google Diversity Manifesto written by jackass James Damore and obviously released afterwards.
What are your thoughts about that? As someone who came in from the outside, what did you see when you looked at diversity in tech, and what do you think can make a difference?
So yeah, so when I got exposed to technology during that time, it was a huge issue. I mean, it's still an issue, but it was like a hot topic at the time. Diversity and inclusion in technology. They look at the numbers at Facebook and other companies where there's such a small percentage of so-called minorities positions within these companies. So I actually did a big Forbes piece, V-Series Forbes piece, where I talk about you know, how I see it, my thoughts on it, and you know, at the time that was really a hot topic. But I think personally that for there to be more diversity, I think more diverse communities have to first become aware that opportunity exists in technology, right? That's the awareness part first, mm-hmm. especially at an early age. And then second, they need the opportunity. They need the opportunity and the pathway to get to that point, right? Mm-hmm. And they need the ability to you know, to get the education, the knowledge component, right? Where do they learn how to code? It's not just coding, but where do they learn about different jobs that can be applied, or different professions that can be applied within the technology industry? You know, when you build these startups, tech startups, whether it's a tech startup or you know, a restaurant, small business, whatever it is, any type of business needs different components to it that exist within technology companies, marketing, human resources, so forth and so on. So I think, again, it goes back to the awareness that these underserved communities need to become aware that there's opportunity there. Mm-hmm. They need to have the opportunity. They need to have the training or the knowledge. And then they need to, you know, see that pathway to that. And that's why when I was out in Cali amongst Ben, I was inspired to create VC Life.
This is VC Life. This what keys be like. This what G's be like. Live a TV life. This is so remarkable. Thought it impossible, but I'm unstoppable. Don't make me conquer you.
No, VC Life to me was like just living that life at the highest level, right? Because if you shoot within technology, or even if you shoot to be a VC in the technology industry, pretty much wherever you fall, you're going to be good. So I wanted to bring that back to the hood. And I wanted to tie hip hop into that. That's why I created Tech Hop. And, you know, I came up with that genre because I wanted to be able to bring that to the hood. Everything that I'm doing is beyond me. I'm really doing this selflessly because I want to bring this back and give opportunity and bring that awareness. So it's not just me just saying what needs to be done that's gonna help diversity and inclusion in technology or any other industry, but it's all about me doing it. Mm-hmm. Showing I'm the most diverse and inclusive it can become in technology. If you think about my background and who I am and what I've had to overcome, you know, Ben opened the door for me, man. Mm-hmm. He was my savior in that regard. You know, exposed me to something different, and where I've changed my life over the last 3 years. You know,
yeah.
And peace and blessings to him and his beautiful wife Felicia. You know, she ushered me in, man. She makes a lot of things happen, man. I'm really, really grateful to both of them. And that's why, yo, I always give my praise to them whenever I, you know, speak out about my story and my history, because where I'm at now is directly related to them giving me opportunity.
Yeah. And speaking of where you're at now, tell me a little bit about your company, Black FinTech, and specifically the Black Card, which I know is a product you're working on. And it's in somewhat of a problematic universe, right? This kind of prepaid debit card, which is an industry that has come under a lot of criticism.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely.
Prepaid debit cards, including Russell Simmons' Rush Card, have long been criticized for having high fees and for being less than transparent about those fees. Annual fees on some cards can range as high as $500.
Let's speak about that. So Black is an acronym that stands for Building Leverage Acquiring Knowledge. I wanted to take the ethnic and racial connotation out of the word Black because I wanted to be expansive and broad. And I wanted to tie into who I was as an individual. So Black, for me, building leverage, acquiring knowledge, was a process that I've always used to succeed in life. You know what I'm saying? Throughout the drug game, so forth and so on. I always was able to get knowledge. And I was always able to leverage that knowledge. You know what I mean? To get to the next level, mm-hmm. or to find success. So I named it Black. My company's Black FinTech. FinTech's it's financial technology.
Right.
So Black FinTech basically is a online and mobile financial services and technology company. And we build affordable, tech-driven, personal financial and banking products with a focus on the financially excluded and disadvantaged unbanked and underbanked. So we also have a social impact component consisting of financial literacy and entrepreneurship education, wealth building. So we basically say we empower financially excluded to build wealth. And that's the premise of the company, or the objectives and mission and vision of the company. So we're trying to really create a suite of financial tools
mm-hmm.
for those people who are underserved and overlooked and don't have that financial access. And it's not affordable for them. So one of the first things I started creating, the first product, is the Black Card. It's going to be a debit card that we're working on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to be positioned where it's usury and where it's with high fees. And it's not predatory. We wanted to take away the high fees. We wanted to give, you know, lowest fees we can and still make money and be profitable
mm-hmm.
and, you know, give investors a return on their investment. So in that regard, the product is positioned in a way that it's you know, in the sense that you look at prepaid debit cards now, they're a necessary evil, mm-hmm. if you would. But the way we're trying to position this is where it's necessary at a point. So that's the first touch point or point product for an individual that we're going to take on a financial journey to building their financial health and being able to optimize their financial lives. So we may start with just a prepaid product, and then we bring them to a secured credit card product. Then, you know, and then a full blown credit product. Then we're gonna also introduce other products such as microloans, mm-hmm. things to bring people to a state to optimize their financial health and their financial lives, where they can build and manage wealth.
And with the Black Card specifically, are you worried about trademark issues? American Express, of course, has a Black Card.
I got a Black Card and let sex have it. These Chanel bags is a bad habit. I do balls, damn Mavericks. My Maybach, Black Magic.
The American Express Centurion Card, commonly called the Black Card because of its color, is issued by invitation only. It has an initiation fee of $7,500 and a $2,500 annual fee. In theory, the card has no preset spending limit, but the company can decide to authorize or decline purchases. The largest purchase ever made on the card was $170 million for a painting. Chinese billionaire and former cab driver Lo Yi Chen used his Black Card to buy Modigliani's reclining nudist auction for $170 million on November 9th, 2015, and yes, he got MX points for it, just like he did when he dropped $36 million on an ancient cup in 2014.
We've discussed that. I've discussed that with Black's attorney, how we're going to position that. We're still figuring out exactly how we're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much concerned with some of the thoughts I got back from the attorney. Not so much concerned with that. The basis of the lawsuit that American Express did win was that they used the word Black, B-L-A-C-K, even though just us spelling it different doesn't give us so much more legal rights.
There was already a lawsuit involving you and American
Express?
No, not Express.
Us. The lawsuit that was already involving the company called Black Card Inc.
Ah, okay.
Right. American Express sued them. They used the word Black Card. American Express won because Black Card Inc. couldn't show, I've read the case, they couldn't show that there was an alternative meaning to the word black, because you can't trademark it as a color, mm-hmm. right? So there was no alternative meaning, and American Express, even though they don't call their cards the Black Card, which is a Centurion card, it's colored black.
And people call it.
But it, exactly, the relationship,
the black
exactly.
Card. Yeah.
And that kind of, and that started from hip-hop. If you think back to what that was the thing that came out of hip hop,
and urban
culture
and so forth.
Jay Z, right. You know, I think was the first to really name drop it like that.
Now I got black cards, good credit and such. Pay poor cause I'm all grown up.
Anyway, long story short, our black has a secondary meaning. It's an acronym: build and leverage acquiring knowledge. So we've been talking to our attorneys and we're trying to figure out, you know, what legal standing we have. And if we're going to proceed with actually calling it the Black Card.
Interesting. Okay. Great. And one final thing that I noticed just about the way you talk, and that ties into some of the ideas of the gods and earths and some other stuff, and I thought it'd be a good ending point. Whenever you talk about Black people, Latino people, you use the phrase so-called minority. And I thought that was just such an interesting phrase. And I was hoping you could tell me why you say that, why you use that with such regularity.
Yeah, because I'll be honest with you, Sean. To maneuver in the world that I'm maneuvering now,
mm-hmm.
I have to hold back a lot of who I really am, a lot of my core beliefs and values and ideals, principles, if you would, in some degree, but not in a way that is negative or where I'm not forthcoming with who I am. but it's more so just to be able to navigate much more smoother, right? You have to, you know, Jay-Z said you have to know how to move in a room full of vultures or something to that effect.
Show them how to move in a room full of vultures. Industry shady, you need to be taken over. Label owners.
You know, you just got to know how to move, and, you know, there's a place and time for everything, right? So, but some things I just can't shift on. And that's one of the things. The reason why I say so-called minority is because original people, as I like to refer to as Africans, Black, Hispanics, Latinos, and others who fall under that original people term, they're the majority on the planet. They're not minorities. When you look at yourself in as a minority or minor, how could you ever be major? How could you feed your psyche that you're minor? I'm a minority. I need preferential treatment, or so forth and so on. All those dynamics of how things are came from different dynamics before us that put those things in motion where you have to have those type of things set in place today, right? But, you know, Blacks are the majority on the planet. You have original and non-original. Only two type of people on this planet. It's original and non-original, right? And that goes back to the lessons. As you know, you studied the lessons, actually. So you came across, so you understand that. So you have the original and non-original. They're all the human family. It's all the human family, right? But African-Americans, Black people, are the majority on the planet Earth. They're only a minority in America. You know what I'm saying?
So it's just a little way to express your beliefs, and it's something that most people, it might get them thinking or might strike them as odd, but they wouldn't even necessarily catch the full import of it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, because I can't go around saying I'm a minority.
Mm-hmm.
In what sense are we speaking? What's the context of understanding that?
Right.
See, I want to go a little bit deeper than that. You see what I'm saying? Not just you just saying I'm a minority. I'm just saying, oh, I'm a minority because I'm told I'm a minority, or I'm treated as a minority, or I'm given preferential treatment for certain things because I'm a minority. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I want people to understand within their psyche what that really is and what's the context of that. I'm not a minority. I'm the majority, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to make sure I feed my psyche that I'm a winner, that I'm major and not minor.
What else is going on for Divine right now?
We just focus on building Black. You know, we build on Black fintech. Kind of just focus on doing that, you know? Also, you know, I do my speaking. I do speaking engagements now, inspirational speaking. Do it to where, you know, it's create a sustainable income through that. That'd be great. So just working on that. Just working how to monetize different value adds that I have. And just keep building my mindset, man. Keep building my skill set. I'm currently enrolled in a Udacity program, digital marketing. Just learning different skills, man. You know, and just building Black. That's really the focus. And I'm reconsidering getting back into music sooner than I expected.
Awesome. Well, Divine, thank you for being a part of our cipher.
Thank you.
As we hint out in the show, Divine and I first connected several years ago. He was the one who gave me the reading list that really began my deep dive into the Nation of Gods and Earths, and started me on a path that culminated in our episode 151 talk with Ala B. Since our first meeting, I've always kept an eye on what Divine was up to, and I was inspired by his rise in the tech world. I'm so glad that we got to hear his full journey, from his start in Rhode Island, to his music career, to his business ventures and beyond. I can't wait to see what comes next. The Cipher will be on our usual summer schedule for July and August, bringing you shows every other week. So join us in 2 weeks on August 28th when our guest will be Bobby Brown. That's right, the R&B superstar will be joining us to talk New Edition, solo stardom, and of course, Ghostbusters 2. We also learn which member of the pop royalty learned his signature dance move straight from Bobby. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cipher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. That's a good opportunity to check out our back catalog. If you like this show, for example, you can hear our talk with Divine's friend Rakim on episode 65. Whatever you use to listen to the show, Apple's podcast, Google Play, seriously, whatever, go now and give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow to sign up. Bringing you a weekly show takes at least 20 hours a week, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us just $1 a month, Sean might actually be able to re-up his Black Card. As an added bonus for our patrons, every month we share bonus audio that we get from our guests, either while talking to them after the main interview is over, or sometimes when they give us some extra special material.
join by the end of August to have access to September's file. Previous months have included unreleased music from the likes of Wu-Tang and Chuck D. If you want to talk to us about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
I never really looked at it as a way to make money because I made money selling drugs.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Grabbing kilos of coke and I'm going down grabbing kilos of books.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Wasn't it probably up to something anyway?
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Like Linus with his blanket.
Audio assistance by Rob Van Vranken.
They know what it is. The history's laid down. The legacy is what it is.
Additional audio consulting from Florence Barrow Adams.
But she never really like sat us down and explained.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Carrie Denver.
They're a necessary evil.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
That's what they sold drugs for, to maintain that lavish lifestyle. It wasn't even about a purpose.